prepare yourselves for Ethan and Aaron's Confessions of a Movie Snob, the ongoing discussion of film genres.
And ladies and gentlemen, Trees and Multiforms, welcome to the podcast. Last week, Ethan, myself, and Ed Douglas, we discussed our favorite films of 2012, and now we're done with 2012. This is our first real show of 2013, and so we decided to kick the year off right, and guess what? We've got McGee back. Say hello, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, we are going to do this right. We're going to do this the way that we have. We haven't had you on in, God, 6 months at least.
I missed you guys.
Yeah. Well, we've been doing some actually, we didn't do a show for, what, 3 or 4 months in the summer, right, Ethan?
It was a while. Off and on. Yeah. You know, there were a couple weeks in between a few of them. But,
yeah. It was nuts. It was nuts.
Summer reruns.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess so.
It wasn't sweeps anymore.
No,
so.
It wasn't sweeps anymore. But what we decided to do, since it's a new year, we decided that we are going to, and by the way, it is now 2013, meaning we survived the 2012 Mayan apocalypse. Therefore, tonight we are going to be talking about the our favorite of the post-apocalyptic films in genre, as a genre. So, should be interesting. Just a side note, I was thinking about this, and new year. Now we get to try out our radio voices. Use your new voice, Ethan.
Hello.
This is my radio voice. No, we're not going to do any of that. I was thinking about it, and you know how people are, you know, primed to call, you know, at least Ethan and I think McGee's a little bit older than us, but they want to call Ethan and I, Generation Y or the Me Generations or shit like that? Something like that.
Millennium Generation, I don't know.
They should call us the post-apocalyptic generation. How many apocalypses have we survived now? There was Y2K, there was all the different Harold Camping predicted raptures, there was this Mayan thingy. So, man, we are living in a post-apocalyptic world. And, you know, just like in the movies, they overplay it. I mean, this is a pussy's apocalypse. I mean, everything's pretty much the same, just a little bit lamer, right?
I know. I mean, really. First we got raptured, and now we got, Mayan apocalypse. And, frankly, I still got to make my car payment, so...
Yeah.
You know, I don't notice anything different.
And I don't have a car made up of other cars. What the fuck?
I know.
But, we're going to talk some post-apocalyptic films. It's going to be fun. As per usual, Geekly Happenings, you guys want to talk about anything in particular?
Well, we could mention the whole Joseph Gordon-Levitt being cast in Sin City, Dame to Kill For. That's pretty cool.
Him and Josh
Gordon-Levitt. So.
Yeah, him and Josh Brolin were both cast.
That's another guy.
Yeah, I like Josh Brolin. Yeah, I was thinking about throwing that out there since he's a Ruth Oz nominee, and there's three other people, but fuck them. They don't have news, so they're obviously not important.
That's true.
So, yeah, I like the first Sin City. I haven't read any of the comics, and I'm sure I might like them. They're Frank Miller, right? Are they all Frank Miller?
As far as I know, yes.
I don't have a clue, and he's crazy, but I did like the first Sin City, and maybe this will be a good one. Other than that, I can't really think of any news that we, this burning that we really need to talk about.
Yeah, no, not really.
No? Okay, so therefore, we're going to hop right into post-apocalyptic films. All right, as a genre, post-apocalyptic film is probably effectively referred to as a story taking place in a post-apocalyptic world after society has fallen, right? So we got that part going on. Now, just right out the gate, I think three times in the history of the show I've done three lists that I openly despise, and this is one of them. I don't think I like post-apocalyptic films.
No, there aren't a lot of good ones out there.
And it's one.
And I gotta say, the 80s loved this genre.
Oh,
and
yeah.
By loved, I mean they really like to beat it with a dead horse.
Yeah.
And there were some bad ones in the 80s.
I guess my thing about it is, as far as post-apocalyptic as a story setting or whatever is concerned, I don't particularly have a problem with it. I mean, there's some interesting stuff, and I have some interesting movies on my list that, that can come out of that situation, be it dealing with, whatever the social ramifications are of government falling and, what we do as a species when, we don't have a clearly really define leadership or what we think is we're going to be doing when people aren't looking. There's some neat stuff to be done in there. I find that most of the time that what this is it's zombies in a fucking desert, or vampires in a desert, or cars made of other cars with zombies in a desert. I mean, it's probably not the most important thing in the world. I know that there are some movies out there that can be simply made, that can be made with two people sitting in a two-shot talking to each other, but this is not a very visually pleasing genre, and film is a visual medium, damn it. And so it's just not very fun to look at, for sure, because, like I said, you're looking at zombies in a desert 9 times out of 10. And
yeah.
That's my problem with it. It's kind of like I don't really bother watching haunted house movies anymore. Because
always, you've seen one, you've seen them all.
Yeah, and it almost feels that way with post-apocalyptic films. And I am completely entering in here expecting to be schooled, expecting to be educated by Christopher, but I don't think it's going to happen, because I've been looking, like, since we decided we're going to do this, I've been looking at list after list after list online, and they're almost always composed of the same movies, and those same movies I don't like. So I don't know. I mean, what's so good about this this genre, Christopher?
Well, it is a lot more versatile genre than I think it's actually much used for.
Oh yeah.
I think it can be used for social commentary. I think it can be used for politics. Mm-hmm. And as you guys alluded to about the slew of really awful films from the 80s, that comes from the success of The Road Warrior. Mm-hmm. And or Mad Max 2, as it was known in Australia. And really, I mean, if you look at that film, that film is essentially a Western.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really such a Western, it's really hard for me to associate it with this genre, although it clearly belongs there. So it's one that's maybe not been used as well as, say, the Western. But I didn't have any problem coming up with ten films that I watch over and over and over again, and I'm affected by in different reasons.
I very much did. Go ahead, though. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I'm hoping my list to maybe highlight some of the different things that people have done with the genre over the years, and why I think it's perhaps maybe not in your top 10 ever film genres, but it's one that's worthy of inclusion and discussion.
Well, yeah, I mean, just because I'm not a particular fan of it doesn't mean it doesn't really need some sort of discussion. I'm hoping to pick up some movies here that are good that I can watch. But you know, as mm-hmm. it stands, like there are movies on this list that I don't particularly like that I have on here so I can have 10. I mean, it reminds me of when Ethan did his zombie list, because he's like, yeah, I've seen 10, so I guess I have to put all of them in there.
Pretty much.
And I've seen far more than 10 post-apocalyptic movies.
Yeah.
They just don't, whatever reason, they don't do it for me, whether it's a deficit in meaning or the genre.
It's definitely one of those genres that there are a lot of bad ones out there. And I think this is one of those genres that's even more so than others, with the possible exception of vampire film.
Yeah, that was rough,
what's that?
I said that was a rough one, too.
Oh, yes. But, you know, where you have a lot of these movies, and I would say arguably 90% of them are just utter crap. And unfortunately, you know, most of the ones that I guess Aaron and I have seen have been in that 90%. And there are a few that, you know, okay, that one's pretty good, or that one's at least fun and entertaining, and that one's god-awful and wrong. And then, you know, you have what I find with these post-apocalyptic movies, look around, is just it's more interesting to look at them in the era they're made, and as far as what they thought would bring about the end of the world.
Yeah. Remember before Mel Gibson was an anti-Semite? Weren't those nice times?
Yes.
You know, just yeah, I get you there. I get you there.
But you know, I mean, there's the nuclear holocaust. There's the in the 90s and in today there's the Like, well, we ran out of water, and, you know, and then there's the zombies, and, you know, it's usually some monster, either some monster takes over the Earth, and humanity becomes endangered, or some cosmic event happens, and that wipes things out, or it's some horrible virus, or it's nuclear, or we do it to ourselves, you know, and that's pretty much it. Yeah. With some exceptions out there that are generally the better, you know, at least the more interesting exceptions.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I mean, I'm looking at my list, and there's definitely movies in here I like, but I don't think that I like them because they're post-apocalyptic. I think that that's secondary to me. I mean, I don't even know if it would necessarily turn me off to a movie being it post-apocalyptic, but in this case, I mean, I'm looking at these movies, and there's not one of them I'm all like, damn, that movie works because there's zombies in a desert and cars made of other cars. I mean, it's just, you know, it's the context of the story, and I think, like Christopher says, is that it can lend itself well to, you know, lots of different ideas, but in... I don't know. I think what's happening here is I have a very mainstream diet of post-apocalyptic movies, and therefore, you know, I just don't like them because I don't have a particularly mainstream taste on many other movies. But in this case, it's one that's all I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, why don't we just get moving on this, Ethan? What's your number six favorite post-apocalyptic movie?
Well, I guess searching through the various post-apocalyptic movies that are out there, you know, one always sort of came to mind for me as one I saw quite a while ago, and it was at least entertaining for me. And I haven't seen it in quite some time, but it's the 1975 movie A Boy and His Dog.
It's a good movie. I like that one.
Directed by L.Q. Jones, all I remember is Don Johnson in it.
Yeah.
And Talking Dog.
Based off of Harlan Ellison's short story, if I remember mm-hmm. correctly.
Yeah, and with the exceptional appearance of Topeka, Kansas in it, you know.
Underground Topeka, Kansas.
Yes, underground Topeka, Kansas. And it's obviously, this was sort of, you know, this product of the 70s, this sort of oddball... apocalyptic movie that sort of seemed like it was halfway, and you know, it works out that it's in 1975 because it's halfway between the 60s and the 80s, you know, and it definitely feels that way. You know, just oddball ass movie, and you know, I remember it fondly. I would be afraid to watch it again anytime soon for fear that I would absolutely hate it, but that's why it ended up on number six at my list.
I think it holds up, honestly. I think it's a pretty good one. Yeah. So, you've seen it, Christopher?
Oh yes, very much so. Yes.
Okay. Very good.
Well, you have to understand. My wife has a lot more conventional taste in movies than I do, yes. And that's one of those rare films that we both can agree on. You know, me. It's that rarest of all beasts. It's a Harlan Ellison story that is actually true to its source material. It isn't just James Cameron ripping off a couple of Harlan Ellison stories and not giving Harlan credit for it. You know, this is 100% unabashed Harlan, and it's got a dog in it, so my wife likes it.
Yeah, I like dogs, and that dog's dead. But at the same time, with this movie, Harlan Ellison is obviously very infamous for. First off, he's very litigious, and he also just really likes to kind of like, you know, like just attack this stuff after it gets made. He never likes anything that gets made into a movie or anything, does he?
He likes this.
He does like this, but he hated the last line where she has exceptionally good taste. I guess he thought that only, you know, that kind of destroyed almost the entire movie, but he did like this to a certain degree, and this is one that he at least didn't sue. So I guess that's a victory. I mean, if you're writing from him as a source material. So, okay, very good. What's your number five, six, Christopher?
Oh, I thought we were going to talk some more about A Boy and His Dog.
If you want to talk about it, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to throw in, it's a film that I like. It's one that I do go back to every now and again. But, you know, to me, the fact that it is unabashed Ellison, mm-hmm. This may be the most perfect distillation of the man himself, because the great things about Harlan is that he's raw and fearless, and the mm-hmm. film is certainly that, especially in the ending, yep. which we haven't spoiled it yet, so I won't hear. But yeah, that's an unapologetic ending that no movie made today would get within a mile of.
Oh God, no.
No. Nope.
You know, but you know, you also get the other side of Harlan in that film, in that it can be petty and smug. And, you know, where you hit that big middle section where it's just Harlan going, fuck you, Midwest! Fuck you for being the Midwest! You know, that's, you know, how dare you call me short! You know, that's a little harder to take. But, you know, just, I mean, the fact that you can sit back and watch this and see something with an author with a very talented author with a truly unique vision, actually getting that on the screen for once.
Yeah.
That just makes it such a rare gem on those terms. You know, that makes me want to come back and appreciate it periodically again and again and again.
Yeah, no, that's a good one.
So I'm talking about my number six?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
My number six, I went with the 1964 version of The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price.
It's a classic. It's a classic. I didn't put it on my list.
Okay. Well, that's funny that you guys say that, because you said you have films that you don't like on your list,
mm-hmm.
and this is a classic and didn't make the cut.
That could also imply that I don't like this one.
Oh, so you're just saying classic in the sense it's old, not good. Okay.
Classic doesn't mean I like it. Classic means it added to the genre.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fair enough.
That was also Ethan's word, but I will accept it.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I mean, and I'm not going to argue that it's a perfect film. I mean, you know, pretty much everybody associated with it has disowned it.
Mm-hmm.
But I, again, not a perfect film, but there's so much in there for me to like, because Bleak is really, really hard to pull off in films. Technically easy to do, but most filmmakers don't have the courage to go all out and show you anything approaching the real horror of what they're suggesting. And there are a lot of moments in Last Man on Earth where you get a great sense of what it would be like to actually be in that situation. And the fact that it was shot in Italy and is dubbed, you know, to me that kind of adds to the bleakness of it. Like, for instance, those wordless scenes where Vincent Price is taking the vampires that he's killed to that mass burning pit, which is, you know, you find out from the flashbacks, has been burning for years because there's so many dead bodies still in it.
Yeah.
And they do that wordlessly, without calling attention to it. It's just they're giving you credit for having paid attention to notice things like that. And Price gives a hell of a performance, I think. You know, the way that when he's not being made to spout out too much dialogue, you know, I think he does a great, great job of showing, you know, just how the real horror of that situation. And I know that they redo this moment in the Will Smith remake. It is, of course, one of the many film versions of Richard Matheson's I Am Legend.
Mm-hmm.
But for my money, the scene with the dog in the Vincent Price version is the most heartbreaking of all. And that's all on Price.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though they're on a budget, I think they pass that all critical test in this type of film, where they do a really, really effective job on not much of a budget of showing you the world falling apart. You know, just that one day where they show Price going into work and he's the only one left. It's him and his boss, and everybody else is not at work because they're dead. You know, little things like that where you see the routine of life just gradually starting to fall apart. To me, that in many ways is more horrific than a lot more blatant things that you could possibly show. So there are a lot of bad touches in it. You know, Price is the only one in the film who can act. You know, it's kind of good the rest of the world is dead, because apparently, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of acting and talent before this particular apocalypse hit. But still in all, just so many good scenes in there. I put it on my list unapologetically, even though it's not a perfect film.
You know, I haven't seen this movie in probably 15 years. And it's one of those that, you know, I think when I watched it 15 years ago, it was, I wasn't paying all that much attention to it type of thing. And it's one I need to check out. It's the main reason I left it off my list, is because I really just don't remember it that much. And I'd rather not, you know, just say it's a black and white movie with Vincent Price. Anyway, so no, nothing against it. It's going to be very apparent that my for the most part, my choices are much more lowbrow.
Yeah, that's gonna be the case for mine too. This is one that I watched on Sunday, so it's fresh in my mind. I think that my dislike of it, and I don't actively dislike it. I just don't like it very much. But I think it's just, this is such a good novel that anything that doesn't nail like the original tone of the novel, the original idea of the novel, I just can't like it. I mean, I could, if I hadn't read the book, I might like this better, but it's just disappointing. It's just disappointing. And I know I shouldn't take that into account, but I don't know. It's hard to take your experiences away from watching a movie if you've read the book. And I just don't think they've done it yet, especially in the Will Smith one. I mean, especially in that one. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, it's not a bad movie, not by any stretch of the imagination. I just don't like it. So, yeah. So, okay. Moving on to my number six. My number six is one that, it's the John Hillcoat 2009 The Road, based off the Cormac McCarthy book. I haven't read the book, and I understand that it pales in comparison to the book. I should read it. I haven't read it. Fuck, is it a depressing movie? It is so depressing. I mean, it's you know, Viggo Mortensen walking around in the desert, digging up Coke cans, giving them to his kid. You know, they're just pretty much looking for food, wanting to stay warm. At one point, somebody steals all their shit, and they go and track him down, and they steal all their shit back, and they steal all this shit, and they leave him naked, and then they leave. And it's an interesting, I guess, it's just an interesting, I don't know, exercise in what it takes to be part of society and why we are outside of it and how these people interact without people watching over them. So I chose it for my number six. Have either of you two seen it?
I haven't seen that one, but I mean, you did touch on a good point. I mean, it's sometimes what makes these movies good isn't exactly like, well, it's about this. It's about, you know, this world where, you know, nuclear war has been horrible and everyone is, you know, running around in diapers and doing all this. But this is one of those that, from what I understand, what you just said and what I've heard about it is it's more about people interaction with other people, sans morals and sans, you know, society dictating behavior. And I think that can be very interesting.
Yeah.
And if done right, definitely worth watching.
I think it's worth watching. If Christopher likes Bleak, he probably loves this movie. I mean, this is like one of the movies I think of when I think of Bleak. I mean, it's depressing. It's bleak. It's not pretty to look at, but it's an interesting story. And you know, as depressing as it is, it does end hopefully. So I got to give it that. So that's something. And it's not even like a magic pill that fixes the world. It's just like, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like a little bit of happiness.
Yeah, and that's generally a Hollywood thing.
It's like, oh, crap, we forgot to plant trees. Let's plant trees. Everything, no, it's nothing like that. But yeah. Have you seen this one, Christopher?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's help me with this film, guys. This film has every ingredient for me to absolutely love it. It's got Cormac McCarthy. It's true to the source material. As we have said, it does not spare on the bleak.
No.
But the thing that kills me about this film is the ending. And I have no excuse not to like that ending because it's Cormac McCarthy. He's a very redemptive author. In fact, that's his stock in trade, is to tell you a bleak story and then hit you with a redemptive ending. You know, I think we discussed this at length the two or three times we've been through No Country for Old Men.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And The Road is precisely that. But I don't know what it is, but for some reason, the ending that I know is coming in The Road kills the rest of the movie for me. It seems so false and forced and unearned. Now, would I like this film better if the kid were, you know, killed and eaten at the end? That's such a weird possibility. It would seem truer to what has been presented up to that point. I don't know if I would ever need to see that particular film again. But just, you know, just it's funny. It's true to the source material, and yet the ending still seems unearned, forced, and tacked on. And Does it feel that way
in the book?
Well, the book again, it's true to the book. It's the same thing in the book. And, you know, it's a post-apocalyptic book that Oprah likes. You know, that right there tells you how true to the book it is.
Wow.
So, you know, and I don't know why the ending that I knew that was coming upsets me so.
I don't know that. I don't know. I mean, I can't comprehend it in my head to where it doesn't feel earned. To me, it feels very earned. I got nothing for you. I mean, it's an interesting movie, and
definitely,
it's definitely an interesting movie. So, okay, Ethan, number five.
All right, now I just recently bought this movie on Blu-ray. And it will sadly, I doubt, ever get a sequel. It will probably make some people's heads explode. But it's the Pete Travis directed movie Dredd, with Carl Urban, and it's the new Judge Dredd movie. Yes, I've seen the original Sylvester Stallone thing that came out in the 90s. I have never read any of the comic books coming from that. This movie I thought was awesome. I really, really enjoyed it. It had that very cool, you know, it had that bleakness that is so, you know, needed and so I guess loved in these post-apocalyptic movies. And this one had an interesting way of, obviously it had the big 3D gimmick going for it, and it had an interesting method of sort of having this main hero who you never see his face throughout the whole movie. He's got the helmet on and everything. So it's really hard to sort of sit down and analyze this movie. I mean, it's based on a comic book that I've never read, and my only prior exposure to it was a Sylvester Stallone movie.
But, you know, I think to get across the real effect of that movie, you should describe it as a Sylvester Stallone, Rob Schneider movie.
Oh, yes. Sylvester Stallone, Rob Schneider.
M. DeLong.
Epic, yes. And judging between the two, and as I understand it, this one is much more in tune with what the comic book is like and what the world that it shows is like. I think this one gives a very interesting an interesting view of the future. It's obviously very, very a very pessimistic view of the future, and yet it has this this gem in there as far as these judges who are running around doing this thing. And there's a great part in the movie where Dredd is talking about the response rate of the judges in Mega City 1, and he's like, it boils down to less than 3% of the crimes that are reported get actually investigated by the judges because there's so much crime out there. And it's just, I went and saw this movie on my own and was just thoroughly entertained by it. So it hit number five on my list. And I guess one of the big reasons it's ending up on my list was because it wasn't out for our, post-apocalyptic movie marathon we had on New Year's Eve. So I couldn't watch it then, so now I can talk about it now.
Yeah, you brought it up in your favorite movies of the year show we did last week. I still haven't seen it. I'm not opposed to that idea. I just haven't seen it. I actually forgotten about it. I forgot it was even coming out for probably four months.
And it sadly tanked at theaters, so we'll never get another one, which is annoying because I liked it.
Yep. Didn't see it. Did you see it, Christopher?
I think it was on in the room while I was writing, and I got everything I needed in like 2-3 minutes there.
Okay. Well.
But hey, I'll pay it a compliment.
Okay.
The source material is an adolescent revenge fantasy, and the movie's an adolescent revenge fantasy. And
there you go.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I just, you know, nothing at 44 I really need to see.
There you go.
Now you give me a middle-aged revenge fantasy. Oh, I'm there.
Django Unchained. But, okay. What's your number five, Christopher?
I put the well, if it needs to be said, the 1968 version of Planet of the Apes.
Number 8.
Oh yeah. Okay. All right. Somebody's with me on this.
As a post-apocalyptic,
it's my number 9.
As a post-apocalyptic film, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of it, but as a post-apocalyptic movie, it doesn't get a whole hell of a lot better than that. Especially since you don't know what you're watching, and it isn't just, you know, zombies in the desert and cars made of cars. So okay.
And let me tell you why I think this is a cut above the other post-apocalyptic films, and I dare say you guys might be willing to go along with me on this. Okay. It's the main point of it is not to sell you the bleakness. It's not a cheap Road Warrior ripoff. It's a film that wants to make a comment about the nature of human beings, and it just happens to use a post-apocalyptic setting to make that point. Now, it's not a perfect film. You know, as many of you may already know, it was a Rod Serling screenplay that was worked over later by Michael Wilson. Mm-hmm. And the Rod Serling stuff in there is still timeless and classic. That opening speech where Heston is talking about how, you know, I went into space because I can't help but think there's something out there better than man. And the film is almost sunk by the really high, cute stuff that Michael Wilson put in later, like the scene at the trial where the three orangutan judges do the see no evil, hear no evil, and... You know, they go by the funeral and the, you know, he said, I never met an ape I didn't like. And, you know, there are bits like that that almost make me want to dig up Michael Wilson's body and punch him. Because they're just so tonally at odds with what Serling was going for. But, you know, the fact that, you know, they never totally get away from Serling's vision. Mm-hmm. And God, it's been done to death and parodied to death. Do we even need to say spoiler alert for the ending?
Yeah.
But what a kick in the head that was back in 1968. I was lucky enough to catch it for the first time on TV around 74, 75, when it still had some of that original power to it. And really, the good things about this film, I think, far outweigh the bad. And if it weren't for the fact that I just happened to find some more perfect films to put ahead of it, this could easily top a list of this genre.
Yeah, and have you heard the story about my dad seeing this when he was going to Brigham Young University?
I believe I had, but feel free to retell it if you wish.
Yes, my dad actually was working in the film department and everything, and they were showing this movie, and the university had them cut the ending. before he finds the Statue of Liberty and everything, it ends right before that. Which
good old Brigham Young.
Which just completely changes the whole movie entirely. You know, like that's the punchline. That's the point of the movie. And without that, the movie is just this sort of hokey monkey movie. And I think that right there encapsulates Brigham Young University right there. But
wow.
No, Planet of the Apes is a great movie. It's had numerous sequels. And of course, the most recent ones are pretty terrible. And they really have lost sight of what made that first movie really, really special. And it had, as we're going through this list and I'm looking at mine, I'm sitting here realizing that really the post-apocalyptic genre for me isn't one that I really enjoy that much. Unless I get something else out of it, as far as some great action or some good comedy or something like that. Unless the movie is just really, really good and has a really good, a really strong message to it or a real strong story to it. And this would be one of those, I think. Planet of the Apes has, I think we, Aaron and I sort of suffer from it because it's, suffer just because it was, you know, it came out 10 or 12 years before we were born. And so we sort of missed that initial impact.
Yeah, we've always known, you know. Sure. I mean, it's, you know, it'd be like, you know, when Chloe grows up, she's always going to know that Bruce Willis was a ghost in The Sixth Sense. And we've always grown up knowing that that it's Earth the whole time. And so you know, it would have been something else to experience that in the theater or for it to be part of our own pop culture.
If we could find like some small child that has been raised by wolves out there, you know, like Nell or something, you know, who has never heard anything about this, we can sit them down and watch it and they can be, they can get that enthusiastic, you know, amazement out of it if they, obviously know what the Statue of Liberty is at that point. But
did by any chance, did you guys pick up the original DVD release of this?
The original, no. Like the one that came out like in 2000, 2001?
Yeah. Yeah, it comes in a big slipcase with the Statue of Liberty on the outside.
Yeah, they all have that. I've noticed that. They yes. Must always show that the Statue of Liberty. Just yeah.
Thanks, Fox.
Yeah. I think that they just like the boat has sailed on that. Everybody fucking knows. Yes. So why don't we?
I think after 20-30 years, they that's the cutoff for the spoiler warning, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I put it on my list because I thought it was a neat twist.
That being said, I expect to see a copy of Citizen Kane out there with the sled on the front now.
There is a DVD box set of Citizen Kane that comes with a little rosebud sled. I've seen it. It was a VHS. I saw this like in probably the mid to late 90s. It was like one of those Suncoast specials. It came with a VHS copy of the movie and like a miniature rosebud sled. I just thought, wow.
They should just ruin movies like that just with like stuff on the front, like see Psycho. It's really him all the time.
it's almost like we're doing like translations of the foreign titles of them. Like in South Korea, Citizen Kane was known as It's His Sled.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what I put on my list because I did like the post-apocalyptic elements of it. I mean, mm-hmm. Let's ignore the fact that the rest of it's kind of a goofy monkey movie, but like the post-apocalyptic ending, like twist ending, was cool. And it's one of those things that as a movie person, it is fun to discover. And granted, it would have been more fun to discover in pop culture at a theater versus mm-hmm. Just growing up knowing it. So,
and I think part of it is Aaron and I at least are not of a generation that grew up really with that threat of nuclear war, that threat of eradication. And I guess, if you do, when you do see the movie and you see the Statue of Liberty, that sort of is lessened a bit by really the era in which you were raised.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely. I would agree with that.
I'm not taken away from the movie. I love the movie. But.
I don't love it, but it's not a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. Okay, moving on to my number five.
Mm-hmm.
My number five is one that I'm going to stick on here, and I haven't seen it in a really long time, and I don't really want to discuss the plot too much because I'm missing some key details. But one of the things I like the post-apocalyptic feeling of it, but what I liked about it most was kind of the atmosphere. It's the 1998 Alex Proyas flick, The Dark City. Basically, it's a movie about a dude that wakes up with amnesia in a hotel, finds out that he's being framed for murder and he's running from the police and all kinds of wiggity shit happens in the, all kinds of wiggity stuff happens. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. I had a real hard time, categorizing that one as a post-apocalyptic type of movie. In that it doesn't even take place on Earth, it's actually Dark City ended up actually being on my list at it's my number four. Never mind. I sort of had a hard time categorizing this one as post-apocalyptic because it doesn't even take place on Earth, but it ended up actually at my number four. So it was one of Alex Proyas's few good movies.
It's one of his few movies. Also,
one of his few movies and one of his few good ones.
Yeah.
Dark City, you're right. It's a real interesting, and we've talked about this in our noir, sort of our neo noir weirdness, that this movie really has this weight and noir aspect to it. But it does take place seemingly after an apocalypse on Earth, or at least these people have been kidnapped from Earth, that sort of thing. So it can be a bit of a stretch for Dark City in there, but it is a beautiful movie. It's fascinating. It's got a great director's cut that's available, which is nice. And yeah, I mean, it ended up my number four.
Yeah, like I said, it's been so long since I've seen it. I'm forgetting some of the finer details of the plot. I just know that I thought it was beautiful, and I thought it was just stylistically a badass movie. So I liked it. I liked it a lot. I liked it. Christopher?
I appreciated it too. I just don't see it as being part of this genre, but that's not the worst thing you could ever say about a film.
That's true. That's true. That's Ethan's number four, and so brings us down to your number four.
Well, number four, I'm on your guys' show. Another opportunity to talk about a man that I think needs to be regarded as one of the great all-time filmmakers, right up there with Hitchcock, Fellini, who have you. And that's the one and only Peter Watkins. And hey, a chance to talk about a Peter Watkins film. I haven't had the opportunity to slip into a show. And so I'm going to talk about Peter Watkins' landmark film, The War Game. Mm-hmm. Which, if you're not familiar with it, was responsible for a huge, huge controversy over in England, because he originally shot it for the BBC, and the BBC refused to show it, because Watkins set out to make a film that, as realistically as he could, with the budget that he had, to make a film showing what a nuclear attack on Great Britain would be like. And he relied almost exclusively on what the British government was actually expecting to happen. And the British government went to some quasi-legal methods to prevent the film from being shown on the basis of, well, you can't tell the people the truth about what would actually happen. They can't handle it. And it eventually wound up getting a theatrical release simply because there was just no other way that Watkins could get the film out. And again, it's not a perfect film, because there are times when, you know, the narrative will stop so that we can say, like, all right, now let's get an unfiltered political message. And that you can kind of take or leave, because, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm going to go down a limb here. Not a fan of nuclear war. But, you know, to me, a lot of the politics drifts too far into that. And, you know, if Britain were hit with a nuclear attack, they'd attack back. How dare they? And I don't see that as a black and white clear cut issue the same way that Peter Watkins does, love him though I do. But the bulk of the film, where he's just showing you what they honestly expected to happen during a nuclear attack, to me is devastating for a reason that, you know, I think a lot of other filmmakers don't appreciate. And that's the fact that it's restrained. You know, I mean, nuclear attacks mean different things in different films. Some of them we all get superpowers. Some of them we all have to dress like 80s music video characters because for some reason. But this shows you two terrifying things. It shows you how really, 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 really devastating a nuclear attack would be. And it shows you the really horrifying prospect that rather than being vaporized, a good many of us might live through it. Now, I know that there are probably some people freaking out like, that makes it sound like, oh, nuclear war is no big deal. No, quite the contrary. It shows you why really the survivors really would envy the dead. Mm-hmm. Why the fact that some of us might make it is the most horrifying prospect possible. And it's not big on blood. It's not big on gore. But what there is there, it kicks you in the head. And it's shot in the semi-documentary style that Watkins is famous for, and mm-hmm. It really does give you a feel of you're standing there in the middle of it. I mean, after a while, at least to me, I lose the sense that it's a British film with all the, you know, foreign touches to it, and just get caught up in the human story of it all. Mm-hmm. And I think the film runs like maybe 50 minutes tops. It, like I said, it was originally shot for television, but it's one of the most unsparingly honest 50 minutes I've ever seen in my life. And even though blessedly we're not living under that Cold War sort of Damocles like we were when it was shot, I honestly think every political leader should see this before they ever start about thinking any kind of military conflict. It's still got that kind of power and ability to make you think about the morality of any war, even one that you didn't start. It's that great a film.
Yeah, I've never even heard of this, and it sounds fascinating, and I see that it's actually available on YouTube, like, in its entirety.
Oh, hey.
Hey, it won. Cool. It won an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. I've never even heard of this. This sounds fascinating. I'm definitely going to check this out.
It's definitely worth picking up on DVD, because they pair it with an earlier BBC production that he made. It's a first-hand documentary of the Battle of Culloden,
okay.
Which really one of the all-time great war films ever made. And they both got, like, commentary tracks and supplementary material, both well worth your nickel.
While I don't have anything to add about this because I haven't seen it, I almost put The Day After on this list because it's a nuclear holocaust movie that took place in Lawrence. Kansas, and I decided not to because it, you know, sucked. But yeah,
and it's a TV movie.
And it's a TV movie, and so we got that going on as well. But yeah, have you heard of this one, Ethan?
No, I haven't.
It sounds fascinating. I'm going to be checking this out pretty soon. I'll be checking out pretty soon. So at this point, are we moving on to my number four?
Yes, we are.
Okay, we're talking about a movie about the nuclear holocaust or what have you that takes place in London and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. And sounds like it's biting social and very realistic. I'm going to go the other route, and I'm going to go with the unrealistic version. I'm going to go with the number four, Shaun of the Dead. Everybody knows I love that movie. I've talked about that movie a hell of a lot. I don't really give a shit that it's post-apocalyptic, but it is, and I like it. Enough said. I mean, I love that movie. What else can I add?
It's a great movie. I love Shaun of the Dead.
So, yeah, I mean, this is just going to show my, my spite for this list. But yeah, I mean, I put it on here. It is post-apocalyptic. I don't care. It's just a good movie that I like, so it's on my list. I love this movie. Christopher, you've talked about it before. Ethan's talked about it before. Do you have anything else to add to it?
Not really.
I didn't put it on my list, but I want to apologize to everybody associated with that film because that's an omission on my part. Because really, it belongs on my list. I guess I have it in like the comedy part of my brain.
Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, geez, if we're going to talk about, you know, doing something fresh with both post-apocalyptic and zombie. Oh yeah, this totally should have made my list.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one. So it's my number four. What's your number three, Ethan?
Well, my number three is, reaching into the depths of things. And because I'm not a huge fan of Fahrenheit 451, I've gone with Equilibrium, which is pretty much Fahrenheit 451 with guns.
Gun kata.
With gun kata. I think this is a really underrated movie, quite honestly, and not a lot of people have heard about it or seen it. And it was in theaters for about 12 minutes. say what you will about it. It was sort of marketed as a pretty much The Matrix, which it wasn't.
On the front of the DVD, it says better than The Matrix.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a critic quote.
I only saw this because a friend of mine and I went and saw The Matrix, and there was like a music video thing on at the start of it, and it was featuring clips from Equilibrium, and we were like, what the heck is this movie? It looks pretty cool. And when you watch it, yes, the gunplay is pretty cool and everything. And obviously, it's got Sean Bean in it briefly, and of course, Batman himself, Christian Bale.
Yeah.
But it actually is a movie that has this really interesting tone to it, in that it's this futuristic, you know, it's set in the future, and people take drugs so they basically aren't emotional, and you know, they don't because they think emotions and caring about things brings about the violence that destroyed society. And that in and of itself is kind of an interesting thought of, you know, how would society be if we weren't so hyper-emotional all the time? You know, what if we didn't feel? And it obviously owes a lot to Fahrenheit 451, in that, you know, obviously they burn everything and they have, you know, their little fire squads and stuff like that. But it's a movie that I at least try to tell people about because it's I think it's a good one. I don't really haven't followed anything as far as what this director has done since, but Equilibrium ended up my number three.
Yeah, I've seen it. I don't really know why I saw it. I mean, I'm not saying that, like, oh, I'm too good for this. I just don't know what – I probably caught on HBO or something one night, and it's not great. It's not awful. It's just a movie that I'm like – of all the movies I've seen, this is definitely one of them. And it's a movie that I actually find that a lot of people just hate the shit out of. And there's, to me, there's nothing in that movie that really deserves any real hate. I mean, the worst thing I could think about would be just forgetting it. But, you know, there are some people that hate this fucking movie. And there are people that love it, too. But I just seem to run into the ones that hate it. And I'm all like, really? You're going to go that far about Batman and... you know, gun ninja, you know, whatever. But, yeah, I mean, it is what it is.
That director went on to direct the ultimate classic Ultraviolet.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You have anything to add about this one, Christopher?
Nothing bad, but I do have a good story related to this story about this film about how I saw it.
Okay.
You guys would know better than me, but this was a 2001, 2002 release, as I recall.
Sounds right.
2002.
Okay. I got turned on to this film not long after it came out by a good friend of mine, a good writer buddy of mine, John Goff, and known for his work for Deadlands primarily and a lot of other great stuff.
Just got Deadlands Noir, in fact.
Oh, yes.
We've had him on the show before, right?
John
you
Goff?
Should have.
I don't
should
think
have.
So. I don't know.
You definitely should.
Well, we'll see about that.
We'll have to
you definitely should.
Harass him.
Well, here you go. This may sell the deal. Okay. Goff recommended this film to me. He said, you know, this didn't get a lot of time in the theaters. It's not got a lot of press, but I think you should watch it. I think you'll find it much better than you expect. And along our way of talking about this film, I said, so who's in it? And he said, well, there's this guy, Christian Bale, and he really makes the film. I like him. And I tell you, this guy would make a great Batman.
You know, I think you've told us that story before. I think it seems like in one of your shows you've said something about that before. It sounds familiar.
Well, it's one of the most amazing bits of prognostication, and I remind him of that periodically. I say, why didn't you say that and then like go out and buy a lottery ticket?
Yeah. I don't see where he gets Batman out of the Gun Ninja, but, you know.
You should have him on. You could ask him about that.
I swear we have, but maybe not. I know I'm Facebook friends with him, so I don't know. I don't know. Okay, cool. That's interesting. See, that was what, Ethan's number three?
Yes.
What's your number three, Christopher?
I don't know if I actually need to mention the date on this, but I'm talking about the 1978 version of Dawn of the Dead.
Okay. My only
zombie
movie. I just
recently saw that all the way through.
Yeah, my only
zombie. Do not get it on Blu-ray. Just don't. It is a movie that was not meant to be in HD. Just saying.
Plaster heads exploding and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I only had one zombie movie on this list, and it was Shaun of the Dead. But okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's a film that I one of those films I revisit periodically, and it's funny. You know, the last time that I watched it, to me, more so than it's something. It's been a growing feeling I've had about this film the more I've seen it. But this last time I saw it, I realized how to me, having seen it as many times as I have, the zombies are now the least scary thing to me. Mm-hmm. The parts that really, 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 really hit me hard now are the parts that used to bug me the most. There are some bits in there where you see the beginnings of Romero's worst tendencies that have really, really, really unfortunately borne bitter fruit in his more recent films, and that, you know, he's sort of lost any sense of subtlety for his commentary. And there are some times when he's really, really hitting that materialism is hollow message a little hard for my tastes. But going in and trying to reevaluate those scenes, there are some ones where, yeah, he's making some comments about materialism, but he's also – there are just some magnificently framed shots where he shows the main characters after they've looted this mall, you know, made their little loft safe area – where you can tell that it isn't just the hollowness of materialism, it's the loneliness that's getting to them. And he does that in these wonderfully framed, wordless shots that his actors carry off with great, great, great skill. And to me, those were the scariest parts of the film, and they really made me appreciate how what a really skilled filmmaker young George Romero was. And, you know, to show the entire world falling apart, people being eaten by zombies, and to still kick you in the head with loneliness being the scariest thing of all, that really put that film on a whole new level for me. And, you know, I mean, I know it gets a lot of respect and a lot of well-deserved credit, but that's an element of it I don't think I've appreciated until recently. And I love it all the more because of it.
I like it. I own it. It's again, it's just not on my list because I just wanted one zombie movie on here, but it should be on there. It's a good one. Ethan?
I've seen the original, I've seen the remake, and prior to seeing it again, I think I saw it again last year or year before. I actually wasn't too fond of it until I sat down and watched it with my lovely wife, who's a big fan of the movie, actually. And it's one of those sort of like Unforgiven that I tried watching it when I was too young, and it just didn't interest me. You know, there wasn't enough going on, not enough zombies, you know, eating people or whatnot. And then I go back and watch it when I'm a little older, a little wiser. And I completely agree with Christopher. It has this great, as what makes a good zombie movie is it's not about what the zombies do to people, it's what people do to people. Yeah. And
zombies are the least of their problems.
Yeah, that there's a heck of a lot more nasty things out there. And you're right. The most tense scenes in the movie is when they're dealing with other people, or when the bikers show up and stuff like that. I mean, that's by far, I think, probably some of the scariest parts in that whole movie.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent one. It's a good movie. Mm-hmm. It's a good movie.
And I can't reiterate enough, do not get the Blu-ray.
I have the Blu-ray. And
check the DVD. Just get the DVD.
Or somehow figure out a way to turn it down.
I am curious, though, Christopher, which ending do you prefer?
You're referring to the one that they filmed as opposed to the one that they scripted?
Yes.
I'm sort of a fan of ambiguous endings,
mm-hmm.
Except for that like really weird triumphant music that shows up in the filmed ending. I actually like the more ambiguous one that was filmed. But you know, if they'd gone with the one that was scripted, I would not love this film any less.
Yeah,
I think they both work.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
There's a lot of different endings to that one.
Oh yes,
a lot of different.
Well, you know, I mean, part of the reason I don't own the Blu-ray is, you know, I've got the special edition that has the three different cuts of the movie,
yeah.
And that I'm just not ready to give up.
Yeah,
that's a great DVD.
I don't own it either, and I want it, but I want to get the DVD version of it just because of that.
Yeah, there's a great version of it.
Have you seen the other two cuts?
I have not. I've only seen the Blu-ray cut.
Ah. The extended cut is actually better than the theatrical one. The Italian cut is crazy. Very inferior, except for one thing. There's one scene that's only in the Italian cut. It's a longer scene where Ken Foray's character, the SWAT team member, is having to deal with the two children zombies.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And there's a much longer and much more graphic death scene for the two kid zombies, where he basically just has to fling them across the room and just open up on them full bore. And they linger on his reaction to that. And that's a total punch in the stomach of a scene, because it really does show that, yes, they were zombies, but, you know, they still look like children. And it really delivers the horror of that a lot more effectively. And it's only in that one cut of the movie. And it's the one scene I really wish they'd transplanted to the extended cut, because it's very powerful.
Yep, I've seen all the cuts of it. I used to have the snazzy-ass DVD, but guess what happened to it? It was stolen. I do have I have it on Blu-ray now, and, you know, Ethan's right. I mean, some of these effects, you don't want to see this well because they're just not very awesome. First,
now, you're talking about the Dawn of the Dead Ultimate Edition DVD, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the big black one is like four or five discs. And
yeah,
it's pretty – I used to have that one. It's pretty great. That's pretty great.
Cool.
Okay, at this point, we're going to be moving on to my number three. Once again, my number three is one I've talked about in the past. I don't care the year. I don't think year is really relevant. But it's the Terry Gilliam flick, 12 Monkeys. I like that movie. I'm going to see if I can figure out a way to say on every show this year that Bruce Willis can go eat a bag of dicks. But I do like this movie. I like this movie. A lot of the stuff going on with it's kind of fun to see somebody transplanted from a post-apocalyptic world back into society, and how they just, you know, appreciate little stuff more, like, you know, What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong, and, you know, just getting to stick their head out a window like a dog. There's the whole thing going on with, you know, actually getting to save the world, and the whole cyclical story here that's being told just because it's a, time travel movie, and it's Terry Gilliam, so it's well made. He's definitely made far more movies that I enjoy than I don't. So I picked it for my number three.
Nice.
You guys have seen it?
Yes. I have seen it. I actually completely forgot about it.
Yeah, good movie. Good movie. I like it.
It might have been on my list, but that's okay.
Anything to add, Christopher?
Well, I probably have a unique perspective on this film because okay, well, let me go ahead and admit I'm going to make a fool out of myself here. I'm going to try to speak French. Okay. And that's always a risk because English is my second language. My native tongue is, of course, hillbilly. So I'm probably going to massively butcher the French pronunciation of this. But my first exposure to this was the classic French short film that all this was based on, La Jetée.
La
Jetée. Yeah.
Yeah. La Jetée, you know, I'm remembering that Steve Martin routine, like he died, he tried to speak French, you know, so yeah, that's kind of how I am with it. But yeah, I found that in high school on VHS and absolutely, utterly, completely fell in love with that. And if it were feature length, it would actually be on my list. That's the one reason I didn't actually use it. And 12 Monkeys came along. And it's probably a much better film than I'll give it credit for. But from my perspective, it's like somebody took La Jetée, dumbed it down, and put my two all-time least favorite actors in it. So, I mean it's Terry Gilliam. I hate Brad Pitt. I cannot stand Brad Pitt. I can tolerate him in Seven because the narrative is so good. It makes you forget that it's Brad Pitt. But I mean, Brad Pitt could burst into flames, and I wouldn't micturate on him.
Huh.
So I mean, it's just, you know, maybe if I had never seen La Jetée, I could get more, I could appreciate it more. But having seen La Jetée, it just, I mean, it blinds me to a lot of that film's virtues. They obviously gave it a healthy budget. Gilliam is a very gifted filmmaker. But it's almost like, you know, having been raised on Shakespeare and then all of a sudden says, hey, I've got a Shakespeare coloring book. Isn't that way better? No, not to me. So, again, that's just my cracked perspective, but that's what it is.
Haven't seen La Jetée, but I like this movie for what it is.
Now, correct me.
The Criterion version of 12 Monkeys, they have La Jetée as a
Criterion
extra,
12 Monkeys?
That's what I was just going to ask, because I wanted to say that I thought it was an extra on the Criterion disc.
Yes. I didn't know there was a Criterion disc.
Yeah, I don't think it ever came out on DVD, did it?
Oh, was it just Laserdisc?
Because I remember the Laserdisc. It might have come out on DVD, but it would have been one of the early ones that they haven't reprinted.
Huh, nope. Cool.
But
that sounds like something that needs another pressing, maybe on Blu-ray or something. Though.
Well, I was going to say Criterion is slowly redoing everything in blue, and that's one definitely to hold out for.
Yeah, well, it's all if they can get the licensing for it at that point, but yeah, cool. Yeah,
very good. Okay, that was my number three, so that would be Ethan's number two.
All right, well, my number two, going in the exact opposite direction. We've talked to zombies
24
here and there,
dogs.
But...
Oh, wait.
It's Resident. No, it's Zombieland, actually.
Okay.
And it's a silly movie. He's looking for a Twinkie. It's got Emma Stone. I love Emma Stone. And the zombies are sort of an afterthought to me in this movie. It's unfortunately silly by Bill Murray, but other than that, it's Zombieland. It's my number two. I'm not a big Bill Murray fan. What can I say?
Oh dear.
I like Bill Murray. I mean, I could really. I mean, I could take him or leave him in this. I mean, he was funny. It was a good little cameo. And I completely agree with you that I thought that the zombies were a definite afterthought. And, you know, Jesse Eisenberg, he's right there on that line of interesting to I want to kill him.
I want
to
punch
him
hammer.
In the face. Yeah. I saw a trailer for him for something when I went to go see that movie the other night. And, yeah, there's just something about that guy that, I mean, he's not quite in the Michael Cera territory to where I just want to take a hammer to his fucking curly head, but he's almost there and he's almost interesting. And this is one that, like I liked him in The Social Network, but he was supposed to be an obnoxious prick in that. And I don't think he's supposed to be, I thought you were supposed to grow to like him in this, and I didn't, but I like the movie. Woody Harrelson was good in it. Emma Stone was good. It's Abigail Breslin was in it. I like the Bill Murray stuff, but yeah, it's a good little zombie movie. I think it's worth checking out for sure. Christopher.
Well, okay. Again, this just may be my perspective, but to me, one of the things that I have a very low tolerance for is directors, screenwriters, filmmakers who are just so taken with their own cleverness. They produce stuff which is all about, look how clever I am. And they come up with characters that don't seem like human beings, as they seem like avatars of the writer talking to himself.
That's really common zombie stuff, though, man.
Dawn of the Dead. I mean, the early Romero films, they seem like real people, and that's what I think puts those films over the top. 28 Days Later, the people in that seem like real people to me.
I mean, because they don't seem like real people, that's how The Walking Dead lost me. I mean, because
we could do a whole show on that.
I mean, I don't know. Are you still positive on that one, or have you given up like me?
There are still good points in the Walking Dead for me, but I always knew that for that show there would be that great Rubicon known as Michonne. Yeah. And now that she's on the show, it will never be good again.
They ruined it. They ruined it.
Yes.
I like Michonne in the books okay. They fucking ruined her in the show, but we're not talking about Walking Dead.
Right. Oh. Okay. You know, it's just one of those films where instead of characters, it's little avatars of the writer talking to himself, and these are just situations that are just there because they're clever, not because they're believable. And it takes a very, very, very gifted filmmaker who I can tell is trying to be clever and doesn't just make me want to kill them. The only one who can do that for me some of the time is Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need someone of his gifts for me to ignore the fact that you're just doing this to show how clever you are. That's why I can't get into sitcoms. Sitcoms are a room full of people telling you how clever they are rather than presenting anything up there that even vaguely resembles real life.
Well-lit rooms full of people telling you how clever they are, yeah.
You know, and I mean, as much fantasy as I like, I do need that kernel of something I can grab onto and believe in, or I'm just not going there with you. And this is just a film that was exceedingly clever and completely unengaging to me because of it.
My wife puts it in the Blu-ray player sometimes, and I'm able to happily, not exactly ignore it, but, you know, be just kind of in my own. I'm not really anywhere on it. I mean, it's fine. I don't. You've given it way more thought than I ever have. So.
Okay. That's what I do.
Yeah, that is apparently. We're moving on.
I'm a professor. I'm obligated now.
That's a good point, Professor McGee. Moving on to my number two, right? Is that where we are?
Yeah.
Yes.
My number two is one I don't think Ethan's seen. I don't know if Christopher's seen. It's kind of weird to even be on here because, you know, talking, you know, fucking 12 monkeys and zombies and Zombieland and, you know, cars made of other cars and, you know, all that stuff. But it's the, I want to say 2008. But the Pixar flick WALL-E, I like that one. Again, you know, I think I said it when we talked about it on the when we did our Pixar show. But, you know, I said it's effectively a movie about a toaster. You know, a toaster in a post-apocalyptic world, and the toaster learns to love and all that stuff. And, you know, the story, it's a cute, sweet little story. I mean, it's practically a fairy tale, so it's fine. What I kind of liked about it is I thought it was an interesting movie just technically. I like the fact that it was. I mean, it's not like, I wouldn't call it mostly dialogue-free, but there's big, long stretches of, like, no dialogue, and there's just the bips and the boops from WALL-E when he's talking to Eve, and there's all, like, it's a little bit heavy-handed when they get up on the ship, and you see the big, fat people that are so dependent on technology that they're floating around drinking their cupcake in a cup, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But overall, I thought it was a good movie. It's one that I like watching. I think it's visually interesting. I thought actually, like, I was really taken by the sound design, and that does not happen to me very often in a movie. I rarely notice a sound because you don't want it to stick out. But in this case, it was, you know, exceptional sound. So I liked it. It's my number two.
I still haven't seen it.
I didn't figure you had. Christopher?
I've seen it, and I hate it.
Yeah,
honestly.
Of course you do. You hate fun. You're like the Paul of our podcast.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I don't hate it. I don't hate the fun in it.
Except Christopher actually knows what he's talking about.
Oh, okay.
Well, okay. Here's the thing. Okay. Pixar, when they're at their best, will talk about things that no other films will talk about. You know, they can be terrifically funny, but they also have that element of realism that I think makes them really special. You know, like the Toy Story you know, series about, you know, how, you know, no matter how cool and neat we are and how close we are to some people, they're going to grow and leave our lives. That's a, I mean, that's an adult theme for any film, much less one that's supposed to be an animated film for children. At least that's how most people mistakenly think of them. You know, a film like Up, which is, hey, kids, you get old, you get filled with regrets, and there's no going back.
Then you die.
And then you die. Yeah. I mean, those are some of the best films ever made, especially now. And to me, WALL-E is just, you know, like, all right, folks, hey, we're going to talk about how much we hate Walmart. You know, and it to me, it's just the politics of it ruins it for me. Not that, you know, there aren't bad things to say about Walmart, but I'm just, you know, that's what you guys can come up with after in between Up and, you know, the Toy Story films. I mean, I actually prefer the honest, open, manipulative mercenariness of the car films, because at least the Cars films aren't pissing on my back and telling me that it's raining. You know, there's not a con job going on that you have with WALL-E. So WALL-E, I just thought was, I mean, it'd be a terrible film from anybody, but really coming from Pixar, major letdown.
You're just wrong. You're just flat out wrong. I mean, I usually just give you your 2 cents, but I'm going to say that you are wrong about this movie. You are jaded. There's something missing in your soul to think that about this movie. You are wrong.
Well, you know, honestly, Ethan, excuse me. I'm sorry. You're Aaron. I'm sorry. Sure. You knocked me on my ass. I can't even tell your name right now anymore. But I tell you what, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I thought precisely that as I was watching it. I actually started to worry about my
That is such a cynical fucking thing to say about this movie. Like the Walmart stuff. I mean, fuck that. I mean, there's always some sort of the perspectives and the biases of filmmakers put into something. I mean, it's part of life. We have to deal with shit that we have to deal with shit that we don't like from other people. I mean, that's just part of life.
I didn't need Pixar to make the 7,000th film to take a shot at Walmart.
But that's not what the fucking movie's about. That's like saying that Batman is about, why don't we pump up greenhouse gases because Batman's car, the Batmobile, isn't eco-friendly. I mean, that's just reading into it. I mean, WALL-E is a movie about love. It's about finding your person in this terrible fucking world. Obviously, they have to amp it up and make it kid friendly by making like the shiny little toys and stuff. But overall, I mean, there is the anti-corporation stuff. But to me, it's a movie about it's about loneliness. It's about finding somebody. It's about love. It's about
and if they had stuck with that, I would regard it as a pleasantly mediocre film.
And I've seen this movie several times, and that's never even occurred to me as the anti-commercial, and it's certainly not Walmart. I mean, I think you're generalizing there. I mean, I don't think you're. Are you saying that it is specifically Walmart, or are you saying anti-corporation?
They're indicting us as they're indicting us as being slaves to companies that put out crap at low prices, and just being in the South, obviously that's the metaphor that we tap into. You know, I guess it might be Menards for our Wisconsin friends, but you know, it's just, you know, that to me was just, it was just the same boring Hollywood politics that you get in 1,000 other movies. And I just thought, come on, Pixar, you are the guys who do better.
Again, it's something that's tacked on in the third act to give you some action. That's not the overall – I didn't think it was the overall arc of the movie.
Well, but you see, that's it. I don't go to a Pixar film wanting to see tacked on stuff unless it's Cars. Cars is just all tacked on.
I think we're just going to have to agree to disagree because you're...
Oh, well, I mean, it's me and the rest of the human race. I fully acknowledge that.
Yeah, it is, because this is a wonderful, sweet little movie. That's why I picked it for my number two. At this point, are we moving on to our number ones?
I believe so.
Do you have anything to add about a movie you haven't seen?
I haven't done my number two.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's your number two, Christopher?
The classic British sci-fi film, The Day the Earth Caught Fire. And if you haven't seen it, it starts off with the U.S. and the USSR doing nuclear tests, trying to see who can set off the biggest bomb. And they wind up setting off two huge bombs at the same time. And what becomes gradually more and more apparent to our London-based cast is that as a result of these two explosions going off at the same time, they've jarred the Earth loose from its orbit, and it's slowly getting closer and closer and closer and closer to the sun. And what proceeds from there is a very, very, very restrained but very, very, very realistic story told from the point of view of two or three characters. One's a newspaper man, about how society slowly starts to break down. And it's so gradual and so true as you go. You never question, you know, the fact that, you know, an explosion that would knock the Earth out of the orbit would also turn it to dust. And, you know, it's a very, very human character-centered story. And by the time that all seems lost, the USS and the USSR, they try to reverse they try to set off two more big bombs, hoping that they can arrest the plunge into the sun. And it ends with the newspaper. It ends at the newspaper office. They've got two headlines ready to go: Earth saved and Earth doomed. They're just trying to figure out which one they're going to actually print, and that's the end of the film.
Neat.
Absolutely one of the directed by Val Guest.
Oh, okay.
You may be familiar with some of his other works, but absolutely just for the realism and the restraint involved and the quality of the acting involved in it, you know, really one of the better, more underrated films ever made, and certainly I think a worthy example of this genre.
And it's got Leo McKern in it.
Cool. Yes. Rumpel of the Bailey himself is the guy's editor.
Awesome.
Well, he is Rumpel of Bailey, but he also was number two twice.
Very cool.
Oh, of course, yes.
Very cool. I haven't seen it. Ethan, have you?
No, I haven't actually. It sounds good though.
Yeah, sounds interesting. I'll definitely check it out. Now we're down to our number ones. Now that I've jumped the gun twice in a week, but okay. Ethan, what's your number one favorite post-apocalyptic movie?
All right. Now this one showed up on my. I think this one showed up on my favorite science fiction list. But this one is a. Probably my most, the most deep, most intellectual, most, I guess, for lack of a better term, most good post-apocalyptic movie, and it's Children of Men. Now, unlike when you say post-apocalyptic movie, I mean you immediately comes to mind is obviously Road Warrior. You know, society's collapsed and people are fighting each other and over water, gas, whatever, you know, food, who knows, you know, you expect some distinct image out of Road Warrior, Tank Girl, or Waterworld or something. And this one is very much society. It is post-apocalypse in that there's the people are now infertile and goes in the direction that science fiction likes to do and actually makes a good story out of it of, you know, protecting someone who, you know, can bring life into this dying world type of thing. It's been a while since I've seen this movie. And it's just the movie that came to mind as far as sort of the best post quote unquote apocalypse type of movie that I thoroughly enjoy. So it's Children of Men.
I've seen it once and I don't remember it. I do remember liking it. Wasn't it about, it was Clive Owen, that was the one with Clive Owen where the chick suddenly got pregnant and he was trying to help her have the baby?
Yes.
Yeah, I like that one. It was pretty good. Christopher, do you have anything to add about it?
Well, it's Alfonso Cuarón, whose name I'm probably butchering and proving that my Spanish is no better than my French. Yep. So obviously it's an extraordinarily well-shot film. I mean, that now legendary one-take shot of the terrorist bomb going off.
At the beginning where he goes in for his coffee and everything.
Yeah, I mean, just an absolutely great bit of filmmaking there. And there are a lot of positives of it, but having read the book, I just really wasn't happy with a lot of the changes that they've made to it. The book itself is so pure and so good. To see them make a lot of changes they didn't have to make just to Hollywood it up a little bit, I thought that they're unfortunate. I mean, maybe they wouldn't have distracted me as much if I hadn't read the book first. But it's just, you know, I really, really hate when the source material is changed and it doesn't have to be.
Sure.
So that knocks it down to just being a very good film to me, where it could have very easily been a great film.
I haven't read it, and I just can't remember the movie well enough to really comment too much about it. So, okay. All right, so that's your number one. Christopher, what's your number one?
Well, you know, it worked out very, very well because the first time you guys had me on, we were doing pre-70s sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And you guys gave me a chance to rave about one of my favorite films. And, you know, now this is kind of my homecoming after my six-month absence. And, you know, I'm going back to one of the films that I was really, really happy to talk about on my very, very first show. And it made my best pre-70s sci-fi films, and it tops this list. And that is the MGM Britain film No Blade of Grass, which you may remember me talking about on that very first show.
Yeah, I saw that. But that was good.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it checks off everything that you need for a post-apocalyptic film for me. It's bleak, but not sensationally so. It's got more than enough realism and believability to really where you immediately buy into the fantastic premise of it all. And unlike, say, you know, like my problems with The Road, you know, it gives you all the bleak that you need and then this suddenly happy ending. No Blade of Grass is bleak, 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 and there's a kind of a happy ending, but in many ways it's even bleaker than what you've seen before.
Yeah.
And for all the things that go wrong with it, like the 60s folky Roger Whittaker theme that they play way too many times. And you know, it to me the essential power of the film is undiminished. And to me, I don't know if they'll ever make a better post-apocalyptic film, especially as Hollywood drifts further and further and further away from making unapologetically pessimistic material like this.
Yeah. Yeah, It's it's a rough one. I mean, it's one of those movies that is so fucking bleak. It's hard to watch, but I would recommend anybody watch it.
Watch it once and never again.
Yeah, possibly.
That's all you need.
Did you end up checking this one out, Ethan, after we did that show?
I did not.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting.
It got put on the list of stuff to watch, and it's still there.
That's a long list. It is a long list. Okay, moving into my number one. My number one is going to get into the fact that this is a genre that I don't particularly like. And I actually think that there's a lot of things in this movie that kind of openly I don't know if I'm going to say openly mock, but certainly the stuff I like about it have nothing to do with the fact that it's post-apocalyptic. And it's a movie that actually showed up on this list before and we talked about it, and I kind of was coy and quiet about it when it came up. But it was Ethan's number six. It was A Boy and His Dog. I like that movie a hell of a lot, basically because, you know, it's a fun movie to just generally explain to people. Oh, okay, A Boy and His Dog, what's it about? Well, it's about a guy that can talk to his dog telepathically, and the guy's going out to get laid, and they're just trying to get food. That's kind of what I like about it, because this is a guy that is effectively nothing like anybody, he's not like anybody that we're going to know. This is a guy that grew up without any sort of moral compass. He has no idea about the difference between right or wrong. So him and his telepathic dog are going around looking for food and women to rape. You know, honestly, I could have dealt without all the Topeka shit. I would just like to see a movie about blood and what's-his-face going around and just continuing their antics, because it's actually a kind of a good little duo between the two. Like, the guy, Don Johnson, talking to his dog, and there's a lot of like really funny stuff going on between the two of them.
Especially because the dog's a smartass.
His dog is a smartass. I like it a lot, and I'm a big fan of dogs in movies too. And it was funny. I watched it again today or yes, I don't remember. I watched it recently, and it was funny because I'm a big sucker for like if you want to make me cry in a movie, like kill a fucking dog, right? And like, you know, there's that scene at the end of the movie where, you know, where Blood is, you know, really injured, and you're wondering what's going to happen to him. And I'm sitting there watching him, and I'm thinking, huh, I don't really care. I mean, obviously, I like him, but, you know, to me, it just felt like, you know, what I'd be dealing with in a movie where a character I like was in, you know, mortal danger or whatever. And I'm wondering if giving him that human personification is kind of what it is that kind of made me not care as much about him. And I you know, that's really neither here nor there, but that was an interesting thing about it. And I kind of liked the ending. I thought it was funny. I mean, and I obviously, I didn't write it. I'm not Harlan Ellison, but I love the last line in this movie, well, just, at least she's got good taste, and they walk off just chuckling. It's a really good movie, and I like it a hell of a lot. I'm kind of glad that none of the sequels have had, and by none of the sequels, I mean the probably at this point, 45 different proposed sequels that have been brought up over the years, but I just kind of like this one as a standalone. You know, I don't want to see what happens anymore. I'm just like, okay, it's, you know, it's Don Johnson and his dog, and they're going to go off raping and eating people. It's awesome. So I like this movie. It's my number one.
Bring the kids.
Yeah, bring the kids. I'd show it to
Wake Grandma. Yeah. It's you know, fun for the whole family.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought it was a lot of fun. I liked it. So it's my number one.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it in a very long time. I need
yeah,
to
it's,
I check it out.
It's, what you call it, a public... it's open to public. It's copyright free, so it's on like YouTube, and it is on Netflix, but you can, you know, get it off of public archives and stuff like that. So it's a good one. So okay, I guess at this point we are going to be doing a rundown of our list and sticking a fork in this bitch. Ethan, what's your list looking like?
All right, well, my number 10 starts off very highbrow with very, you know, it's intellectual, it's deep, it's Death Race,
of course.
Then Hell Comes to Frogtown, my number 9. yep, that one, it's Rowdy Roddy Piper at his best, and we all know what that means. My number 8 is Planet of the Apes. My number 7 is Road Warrior. My number 6 was A Boy and His Dog. My number 5 was Dread. Number 4 was Dark City. Number 3, Equilibrium. Number 2, Zombieland. And number 1, Children of Men.
Very good, very good. All right, Christopher, what's your list look like?
My number 10 is the 1960 version of The Time Machine.
Okay.
Number 9 is the 1963 version of Day of the Triffids. Triffid fans?
Yeah, I like Day of the Triffids.
I've seen bits and pieces of it, yes.
All right. Number 8 is the 1960 Ray Milland thriller Panic in Year Zero. Number 7 is the 1971 Oliver Reed film ZPG, Zero Population Growth. Mm-hmm. And then we move to 6, Last Man on Earth, Planet of the Apes, The War Game, Dawn of the Dead, The Day the Earth Caught Fire, and No Blade of Grass.
Very good, very good. My list, I'm looking at my list, and it's looking like up in the in like the 10 through 7. There's still the remnants of when I actually had like a I don't know, a theme to this. You know, there was certain stuff I was going to say that I just fucking said fuck it and gave up on it. But my number 10 is one that, you know, I in no way, shape, or form am I suggesting that it deserves to be discussed in the best of these. But it's one that I want to introduce as a post-apocalyptic film, like, in a way. Because I've always kind of got the feeling that, you know, post-apocalyptic doesn't necessarily need to mean, like, you know, global apocalypse. It just needs to be in the, you know, environment that the movie's told in. So I just said the fucking Dark Knight Rises because, you know, Gotham is in a state of post-apocalyptic and, you know, hey, whatever. And I was really, really, really stretching to get this list full. And then number 9, I'm going to throw a bone to Ethan. My number 9 is a movie that he loves a whole hell of a lot, District 9. Again, following that train of thought that, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be the whole world, but just the society that the main characters are living in. Then number 8 is The Planet of the Apes. My number 7 is a weird one that I caught when I was just kind of going through a weird Japanese movie phase, but it's The Six String Samurai. It's basically a movie where a whole bunch of samurai living in a post-apocalyptic world.
I couldn't get through that movie. I hated it so much.
I hated it. It was so cool. Oh. I hated it so much. It was so cool. But, yeah, it was weird. So I liked it, so I put it on this list. And then my number 6, like we've already been over, is The Road. Number 5, Dark City. Number 4, Shaun of the Dead. Number 3 is 12 Monkeys. My number 2 is WALL-E. And my number 1 favorite post-apocalyptic flick is A Boy and His Dog. And boom, we got through that, guys. Oh, man.
Excellent.
My God. So post-apocalyptic flicks, we got that one in the can. that one was painful for me to get through because it's just not something that speaks to me for whatever reason. But hopefully there's going to be some good ones I'm going to pull off of Christopher's list that
I'll be
able to see. But, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's the whole reason we have Christopher on here is we can write down movies that we need to see.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen every movie that in the past that he's brought up that sounded even remotely interesting to me, and I guess I'm going to do it this. I'm definitely looking forward to looking for some of these. But I guess what we're doing next week is if Ethan and I like to call the Oscars our Super Bowl, then I guess that would make tomorrow our playoffs, because tomorrow we are getting the Academy Award nominations. So I think what we're going to be doing next week is it's going to be Ethan and I going over the nominations and just kind of get into some predictions, talk about any surprises or things like that that's come up, you know, like, holy crap, there's a James Bond movie up for Best Picture or whatever, you know, just, you know, something like that. And it should be a good little conversation. It's going to be fun. So,
most certainly. Plus the Golden Globes are this Sunday, aren't they?
Yes, they are. So we'll probably go over that in Geekly Happenings, and we'll just go over the Oscar nominations in the main bit of the show. But this is some behind-the-curtain stuff, so we can discuss that off the air. So does anybody have anything to add before we say goodbye?
No, just thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure, gentlemen.
That's always fun. It's always fun having you on. And as per normal, don't take my attacking of you as to mean anything but pure respect. But I loved Wally. So hey,
it's quite all right. I've gotten several black eyes from talking about Wally. You let me off easy.
Okay, well that's a good thing.
Well, hopefully 6 months won't go by before we have you on again, Christopher.
Oh, not a chance. We won't let that happen again. Okay. Oh. Well, I have nothing else to add. So I guess until next week, I'm Aaron.
I'm Ethan.
I don't know. Let you eat one. Is done to go walking. A boy and his dog sometimes talk to each other. A boy and a dog can be happy sitting out in the woods on a log, but a dog knows his boy can go wrong. Boy and his dog can go fishing. A boy can teach a dog to bring a dish in when he's hungry. A boy and a dog can be happy sitting out in the woods on a log, but a dog knows his boy can go wrong.
Particularly good.